This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to appreciate all the ways Black music brings everyone together. From the Saturday morning soundtrack that gets the whole family cleaning the house, to the beats at the block parties that bring the whole community together. Celebrate the impact of Black music this month and beyond with State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/westwoodone.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, and also Amazon Prime. And my second feature script is done. Woo!
Yay! I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently really trying to make my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep who used to manage Sundance's creative distribution initiative.
This week, we welcome first-time feature director Brenton Geezer on the show to talk about directing his feature, The 50, after switching careers to filmmaking just a few years ago. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, Liz, how are you doing today?
I'm okay. My daughter is napping and I'm home alone. So I'm talking with my, you know, my sweaty balls NPR voice right now, you know, just trying to be super calm, not trying to ruffle. What is it like? But not trying to like butterfly effect anything. Like if I do one tiny loud noise or gesture, she'll wake up and then all hell will break loose. Other than that, my producers and I are going to have a summit on Friday where we just talk about big picture goals for the film. For those who haven't been listening to every single episode, which I feel like is, you know, I wouldn't presume everyone's listening to every single detail of everything we do. But my third feature was supposed to be made with a intention to be unconventionally made, you know, not replicating the exploitative, low budget practices that we are all known for in the indie film world. And yet, for the past year, I've just been like, oh, production company, love me, big name actor, love me, and really trying to get the embrace of the system. And so my producers and I are going to meet Friday and we're going to be like, okay, what is our real goal with this film? What are we really trying to do? Who do we really want to work with? Let's not think of things like from a scarcity perspective of, but like, what would make this experience delightful? And let's do that. So we're in a big picture brainstorming world right now.
Is it not like what can make the movie happen, the thing that's important? Or is that like less important? It's more like, let's not worry about like the fastest, best, easiest way to make the movie. Let's worry about like the best, most fulfilling way.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to make the movie happen. I'm not really worried about that. Like I'm a person of very firm conviction it's going to happen, but it's the how. And the goal for this film was to enjoy the process. And it's like, the process is really not that enjoyable right now. It's really like kind of the word I've been using over and over again is whiplash, right? We've been experiencing whiplash. And I feel most indie filmmakers feel this way. It's like, oh, what is this? What is this exciting door that's about to open? Nope, slam door. Oh, what is this funder? What is this production company? What is this opportunity? It's like, what is this fellowship? What is this? What is that? And it's because we're so excited by the mystery of potential that it's like, wouldn't it be nice to just decide how we're going to make it and then make it that way instead of being so flimsy and leaning towards whatever idea has the most energy. Like, no, let's create the energy. Let's decide whether we're going to make this over weekends, whether we're going to make it with Namecast, whether we're going to make it for 300K, or whether we're going to change the script to make it for less. Like, what are we going to do? I don't know. So hopefully Friday we'll have some answers.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you what was not enjoyable about it, but I think you did a good job of explaining that, like, this constant shifting of oh, this is the thing we're doing. This is the thing we're doing. And it's you want to just make the movie and have a plan and a process. And it's hard to do that when you're chasing these opportunities, you know. That's also part of what you have to do to make a movie. Like, you have to chase the opportunities because that might be the thing that leads to the movie being made, you know. And yeah,
but if you don't have an anchor, yeah. Well, yeah. Sorry, I'd try to cut you off. I want to hear what you have to say, but
sure.
If you don't have an anchor, each opportunity feels like it could be the anchor, right? So it's like I went to a meeting, and then I went to a meeting. I was telling, I'm in this new filmmaker support group thing, and I went to a meeting. And I was telling people what we're going through, and they're like, "Oh, well, I know of a program that's trying to fund micro budget features right now. Well, send me your script. I'll send it to you." And it's like, I can't put all my eggs in that basket. A really attractive basket. I will put an egg in that basket, but the majority of the other eggs need to be in a stronger anchored I'm mixing so many metaphors, but anyway, you were
anchors
thinking.
Anchors and baskets.
Baskets,
yeah.
Anchors.
No, just that I had that. What was my anchor? I guess my anchor was the money we'd raised, which was nice, you know, and then the crowdfunding campaign. So those were the two things. It was all right, well, with that anchor, we're expecting to shoot this movie in this time frame or this month or whatever. And then and then everything else is chasing, you know, just chasing every single opportunity around it. And then some land and some didn't and some happened and some, you know, whatever. And eventually enough of them landed where we were able to make the movie, you know. And then I feel like, you know, part of what you're talking about is just to think what it is. But then I think, having an anchor of a plan that you can follow, it is comforting, you know, this is what we're doing and why we're doing it this way, you know.
Yeah. What's going on in your brain?
Well, I had another meeting with one of the investors from the alternate, which was fun. And, you know, it's funny. These things are you know, some of them are more like they're friendships, they're just investor pitches. It's just you're just having lunch with a person and just chatting and catching up and hearing about what they're working on and what they think about what you're working on and everything. And so it was more like that kind of conversation. There was no pitching really. It was just more the initial discussion. And it was really good. He seemed to really he hadn't finished reading the script. He'd read 30 pages of it, but he was really into it, it seemed. And he really liked what I had to say. And I was going to tell him more, but he every time I would tell him a little bit, he's like, don't tell me. I want to read it as you've written it. I don't want to have it ruined. I don't want to be spoiled. I was like, okay. Well, just, you know, read it and we'll talk and everything. So, you know, there's definitely some potential there, but I just think that you know, we'll see how it goes. I need to really get back into writing the script. I'm still on my time away from the project right now. And I'm going to have another meeting this week with another person who read it to get some feedback. And hopefully as long as I have time, my schedule's starting to get really, really slammed. But yeah, I feel like I'm ready to open up the project and start writing again. That's the next thing to do. Which is exciting. And then, yeah, I got fired from a job. Not my main job, just that I talked about it a little bit. I was working on a documentary, editing this documentary piece. Fired's harsh, but I mean, essentially what was fired. You know, it was really interesting. I kind of want to talk about why, you know, it happened.
Yeah.
Because I don't really feel bad about it at all. You know, I sort of feel like I was just doing what I would do as an editor and providing what I think my value is as a collaborator. And it wasn't I was saying oh, I'm not going to follow your script. I'm not going to do it the way that you said. I was just this is another idea that I think is really important, you know, and I think that we should discuss it. And I want you to entertain the idea, you know?
Yeah.
And basically I was met with, the first time I suggested it was I pitched this idea of changing the structure and you know, keeping most of it, just you know, doing one different thing And then I got a really long email back about like why it was so important to keep to the script. And he just stick to the script. Just, you know, and if the script is too long, then just because basically I was supposed to be editing a 15-minute piece and the script was a 45 minutes long of content. So I was like, we have to do something here, you know?
Yeah.
And his response was like, just make it 20, 25 minutes long. And then we'll take it from there. I'm like, and just stop right in the middle. And it's like, but the best content was at the end of the script. And so I'm like, this is just, so I was, you know, and then, so my response to that was like, okay, I'm happy to do it your way. No problem with that. Like, but I think we should entertain, you know, making some adjustments and cutting it down. But for now, I'll just edit it as you've suggested, blah, blah, blah. And then then it was like, oh, I want to work with a different editor. Basically. Like, you know, you don't seem to be on the same wave, like on my creative vision. Wow. I'd prefer to work with someone else. I was like, I was like, look, dude, like, you know, like I'm happy to do it your way. I said, like, I'm not going to like try to railroad you here.
Yeah.
It's just like, but if you're not interested in even hearing my suggestions,
then it's not a good collaboration.
Collaborating with me.
You're not a button pusher. Like editors aren't just button pushers.
I'm not a robot. Like you could probably get AI to edit your script for you.
Yeah.
If you wanted, you could just have the computer do it if that's what you want, you know? But like, yeah, like the reason why I'm doing this is because I want to make this thing better.
Yeah.
And I want to work with you to like collaborate. But if you're not interested in that, then like, yeah, I'm not the person to work with. Like, I don't want to just, you know.
It's like when you listen to someone is when they kind of go out of line a little bit and they say like, I know you want this, but please, you know, can we try this? It's like, that's not like an accident. Like you're compelled to give that suggestion, which like the director should be listening to that, I think.
Well, I saw the like some really great stuff in it, and I saw like a really good opportunity to tell the story and bring people in, especially because it's like the whole point of this was to raise money. It's like making this 15-minute teaser trailer or sample piece of a feature-length doc to like try to get this grant, basically.
Yeah.
And so it's like if you're trying to grab people's attention, like you need to actually grab their attention. Like you can't just expect them to like go on your 20-minute journey without like any kind of enticement in the beginning. And he really wanted to like play up the mystery and the suspense, and it's just like it just I didn't see that would work well with this kind of audience, you know. But it was a good experience, I think. I'm you know, and obviously I was paid for my time and all that. Like it wasn't like I was fired with no pay, and there was no anger or resentment, I don't think, you know. But I just think that certain people, they just want it a certain way and they're not interested in compromise.
Yeah.
So that was the experience. And the guy is also, maybe this is a terrible thing to say, but he's an older gentleman. So I think at some point in your life, I think you just decide like, I want things the way I want them. And I don't have time to deal with someone who doesn't want to just do exactly what I want, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that might've been part of it too. And I mean, we'd worked together for years. Like I'd worked on many, many projects with him, probably for like, I don't know, 10 years maybe since I first worked with him. So like, you know, anyways, it just wasn't the right fit, and that's fine. But yeah, you know, what is the right fit is to check out our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIH podcast. This is the way the show will continue to live, to thrive, to go, to exist, to be a show. So check us out there. We don't really have a lot of special things we're offering for our fans right now, but we still do have some stickers and we still do have some pins left. So if you guys want a sticker or a pin, you can, you know, sign up on our Patreon to get those things sent to you by me now and not Liz, because Liz used to do it, but now I do. The other thing that's really helpful is if you give us a review on Apple Podcasts or just a rating, either one's great. That's another way to really help us grow the show and get this out to more people. Without any more delay, here's our chat with Brenton Geezer. We're here with Brenton Geezer, director of the new documentary, The 50. Welcome to the show, Brenton.
Thanks, guys. It's good to be here.
Give us the elevator pitch for The 50.
Straight to the elevator pitch. All right, let's see how I do. So The 50 is a feature documentary about 50 men who were lifers inside a California state prison. And during their sentence, they became certified drug and alcohol counselors. So the whole film is against, you know, essentially the film in itself goes deep into the stories of these men. And this program with them specifically happened about 13 years ago. So we are going back in time to understand the genesis of this program and all that. But, you know, just to give some context, you know, this program came about during a time in the California state prison system where it was densely overcrowded, saturated with drugs, and the U.S. government came down on the prison system in California, saying that the conditions there was unconstitutional. So out of desperation, they decided to throw a couple options at the wall, one of those being rehabilitative programming, and a few of those stuck. And one of them was this one, which, like I said, is a radical, or I mean, like I'm alluding to, you know, it's a radical idea, turning incarcerated people into drug and alcohol counselors and allowing them to be the healers in the own world that they understand and exist in. So the film really goes into that and then really expands into a real character-driven story, examining the lives and the worlds of a couple of those 50.
How many days did you shoot?
Oh man, for a documentary, it's hard to say exactly, but I think we shot about 32 total. Yeah.
Wow. What was the rough budget of the film, if you can say?
We were just under $500,000 for the budget.
How did you first get introduced to this program, or how did you first decide that this was going to be your debut feature length project? What was the origin of your involvement in this idea?
Yeah. So my origin, I guess going back one additional step, I didn't get into filmmaking until my early 30s. I had a whole career, whole life prior to actually picking up a camera. And I actually started with a stills camera and transitioned into motion. But for me, yeah, I went through this career transition. I've struggled with depression and anxiety and a lot of mental health challenges, which is a really central theme to the 50, honestly. And it was that kind of was the impetus and catalyst for me ultimately picking up a camera. There's a lot of middle stuff and interesting stuff in between, but I won't get too deep into that. But during this period of kind of what now looking back on it was transition for me, I picked up a camera and started to take stills, started to do street photography. And that transition from like candid street photography to really actually more being more interested in the people I was taking pictures of and actually stopping people, meeting them, doing more street portraiture, that evolved into documentary photo projects, you know, examining, exploring the lives of people that were living on the margins, honestly. And as I was going through my thing, understanding how people survive in this world that could often really bear down on us. And so I was looking at more extreme stories in that realm. And then, but it kept on, I think I felt at a point like kind of not stifled, but limited by stills. I saw the camera as a mode of storytelling more so than anything else in human connection. And so from there, I ended up doing my first like short documentary project. And I did that on the streets of the Tenderloin. And Ulrich, you know, you're in the Bay Area, you know, the uniqueness of that neighborhood, you know, it's right in the center of the city. It's like 1 mile by 1 mile, but it's where people that are living on the margins of society live, right in the center of the city. And I was doing work in there, and I ultimately made my first short documentary, really kind of figuring out how to do this thing. And as that started to get out there in San Francisco, a friend of mine saw it, and it was just during the time where she met Randy Carter. And if you watch the film, you'll notice Randy Carter is one of kind of the three main characters in the documentary. And so it's Tracy Lewis, who's a producer on the film and now a good friend of mine. She came to me because I was the only filmmaker that she knew, you know. Once again, Ulrich, you know this, right? Being in the Bay, it's a smaller community. She was just a woman who worked in the nonprofit sector that saw my film, got excited about the story of Randy and made those connections. And so I never did a feature doc before. I've never gone beyond the 20 minutes kind of short documentary format. But I talked to Tracy, I met with Randy. And when I met with Randy, I saw this like man in front of me who looked like a former NFL linebacker. But I also saw a man that just like didn't have any masks or any layers that was separating himself from what he was trying to communicate with me. There was this purity, there was this vulnerability that was just so potent to a person that is not system impacted like myself, that has not experienced what he's experienced, but also can relate on some levels of have it be trauma, mental health challenges, and just wanting to be a better person. And I saw that possibility in him. And then so I met with him, and then I met ultimately with 12 other of the 50, and it was the same experience with them. So Tracy Lewis and I started doing this kind of investigation and really meeting of the men, and all doing that while we really dove into, me specifically, dove into the history of the program. And we really found out that this program was a major turning point for CDCR, which is California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. And it kind of shifted. It was the first time they really piloted a rehabilitation program that they put significant resources behind, and a lot trickled down from there afterwards. So I think on the macro story level, it was fascinating in terms of kind of, like I said, the more macro impact. But really what got me was the connection to the men and their transformation and how they showed up in front of me when I first met them.
How long did you start? Have you spent working on the film from, like?
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/Westwood One, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/Westwood One now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/Westwood One.
When I grow up, I'm going to be a veterinarian.
It's awesome.
And I'm going to be what you said we need more of.
So you want to be a plumber-narian?
Do you think I can?
I think that if you work really hard, you can be anything.
Promise?
You bet I do.
When you promise your kids the world, we're here to help you keep it. Ohio's 529 plan is the best tax-free savings plan for future college or career training nationwide. Start now at collegeadvantage.com.
Treat dad to the good stuff at Nordstrom Rack and save big. Father's Day is Sunday, June 16th, and Nordstrom Rack's got gifts dad will love, up to 60% off. Shirts, activewear, watches, cologne, denim, and more. Find amazing deals on Tommy Bahama, Cole Haan, Original Penguin, and Vince. Great brands, great prices. So get to your Nordstrom Rack store now and make dad's day with gifts up to 60% off.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to appreciate all the ways Black music brings everyone together. From the Saturday morning soundtrack that gets the whole family cleaning the house, to the beats at the block parties that bring the whole community together, celebrate the impact of Black music this month and beyond with State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
You know, when you met that these people and you decided that this was the story you want to tell, to now it being released.
So I met Randy 1 month after my firstborn was born. So that was, I met him around December of 2017. So it's been over 6 years. It's been a thing. Wow. So a lot of it is just the nature of documentary. A lot of it is being a first time documentary filmmaker trying to figure out how to do this shit, you know, and not quite knowing how. And, you know, and we had a great production team, but a lot of us, all of us actually were first time feature documentary filmmakers. A lot of people came from the commercial space and have done amazing stuff there, but we're all figuring out this format. So it took 6 years. We were on the festival circuit in 2023. And then finally now in 2024, the film is now released.
If you could change one thing about the film in any way, it could be your experience, it could be the film itself, what would it be?
Oh man, that's a brutal question, because, you know, we're all directors and I think we have a long list, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And honestly, you know, as I told you both, this film was my film school. So there's so many things. I think during the festival circuit, I watched the film a lot. And there were so many things I wanted back, you know, choices in terms of, you know, how to visually represent a moment that's being expressed on camera by one of the guys. Editing choices from the minutia of a simple cut to kind of overall structural stuff. So there's a lot I wanted back, but I think if I could pick one thing, I don't know, actually, I'll say this and then I'll kind of walk it back a little bit too. I think one of the things about the film that I both love and struggle with is that it holds a lot in that the narrative structure of it has this kind of looseness. It floats into personal story to a bigger arc and all that kind of stuff. And some days I'm like, oh my God, I love the decision to do this. I love the beauty of that. And then I think some other days when I'm thinking about kind of more industry related stuff and like how streamers must have interpreted this when they watched it and you know, determined if it was mainstream enough or not. Sometimes I wish I was a little bit more, you know, I focused on kind of key kind of narrative elements, just focused on kind of the thrust of the key narrative a little bit more. So sometimes that's one of the things that I contemplate on. Yeah.
Can I attempt to make you feel better in a brief response?
Yeah, please. I would love that.
I think that people who work at streamers are film lovers and they're wonderful humans, you know, but I don't think this system sets up true curation. So I'm guessing you didn't get like a major licensing deal and you're kind of regretful about that. And I would just say that I don't think it has anything to do with your movie. I think it's just a reflection of a laziness on behalf of the industry, as well as just bad decision making from the gatekeepers. That just want to say, like, I don't think if you have any regrets about how your film is coming across to the streamers, I don't think that should ever be a regret, you know? No,
I totally agree. I think last year during our festival run, I mean, we played at some amazing festivals and we had some incredible experiences. But I think when you're learning, like it's your first film and you guys have both done, I know Liz, you've done two and Ulrich, you've done one. Like we've been through the gamut of like trying and selling films and sales agents and streamers and distributors and that whole world. And it's kind of reductive at times, right? And it makes you feel like, oh, shoot. Okay, I hit 5 of 8 checkboxes, but I need to hit 7 in order to be appealing. And like when you take a step back, and you realize why you're doing this, who you are in this. We're artists trying to create meaningful work that actually resonates on the level of the heart, right? We're not trying to check boxes, right? Last year, I was just in this mode of just kind of, you know, regret and delusion and all this kind of stuff, being kind of beaten down by the process of trying to sell the film. And we you know, we got lucky. We ultimately did sell the film, but I think now I'm realizing that exactly what you said, Liz, is like, I think that realization has made me determine that the next projects I work on, it needs to come from a much more personal source. The 50 did come from a very personal source, and that's great. And it is what it is because of that. But I don't want the market to dictate what I make. It loses the heart. Yeah. So I'm with you.
Well, I want to get to all that later about the deal and the sale and all that stuff. But first, I want to know, like, why did you raise so much money for this movie? And like, because, you know, a lot of documentaries are made for under $200,000 and then even more are made for like under $50,000, where they're just like, you know, 2 or 3 people with a camera and they just like go out and then they just shoot the movie over time, you know, and just do it really small. Like I have a friend who makes like these documentaries where it's just him and a camera, you know?
Yeah.
So just for your first big feature, could you just talk a little bit about like, A, like why you wanted to have such a big budget, and then B, how you raised so much money for your first feature?
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of it was ignorance, and, you know, I'll start there. You don't know what you don't know when you're just getting into the space. And, you know, you hear Orson Welles, like I saw like a reel of Orson Welles talk about ignorance, right? It was like a highlight clip of him talking about the power of that. And I, in my a very small version of that, you know, leveraged that, I think, just not knowing. And I, you know, I think part of that naivete like led me to believe and really dig my heels in about like the experience I wanted to create through this film. ultimately what I found out with this film was like, it wasn't about the program. The program was a Trojan horse. What was interesting, I think, was the story of these men and how we all get to where we are in life, right? The decisions we make, the conditions we grow up in. And I wanted to make a film that was about the emotional content of those pivotal moments in the childhood. And so, you know, Esteban Padilla, who is one of my best friends, producer on the film, Joshua Pisanos, who are amazing Bay Area filmmakers. We came together and we talked about a film that wasn't just your traditional documentary. Yeah, it does have talking heads. It has a lot of beautiful verite, but we also invested in reenactments that, once again, that are like non-literal reenactments that explore the emotional content of our characters in critical moments of their lives. And so all that's to say, those reenactments were kind of expensive. You know, we decided to shoot it on 16.
Wow.
Just for the reenactments themselves, we shot probably 5 to 6 days in decent sized crews. Like we thought that this could be a film, like an immersive experience, you know? And I think it proved right. You know, I think during our festival run and right now, we released the film this week and we're also doing like a screening tour during the release. And I just had the opportunity to watch the film at USC Film School IMAX Theater, the Zemeckis Center. And that was an amazing experience. And I saw that money go to good use. It was that immersive experience that we've always set out to create. I think we did it. And so I'll say that for number one. And then number two, the how part. I think, you know, a couple things. One is that, like I alluded to before, I think just from who I am, I, you know, like I said, I had a career about 10 years in that career was, you know, in tech, but also nonprofits, but really working partnerships, you know, marketing, sales, all that kind of stuff. I came into this world with like a level of a business acumen of knowing how to, I guess, sell, you know, a little bit. And so I'm unabashed about trying to, like, with a project I believe in, and I believe in the impact of the 50 in the program, there's a very strong case for a very strong social impact campaign around this film. So I was unabashed about really finding the resources to make it work. So we started off by raising about $40,000 through more philanthropic routes first. And we got that to get off the ground, to shoot our first couple interviews, to kind of develop a little bit more. And then as the idea for the reenactment started to emerge, and we also knew the scale of this doc, right? We're talking about 50 people and we're talking about experts. We're talking about the men who were part of it. We wanted to show that scale. We knew it was going to be kind of an ensemble world we're creating. In that case, we needed to kind of shoot for the stars a little bit in terms of budget. And so at that point, we were able to find a real cause-aligned film financier who jumped on board and decided to executive produce the film with us and come in for the rest of the budget. So a lot of it was ignorance, a lot of it was luck, and a lot of it was just really like hustle to make it all happen.
So knowing that this is a second career for you, I mean, 32 is still very young. So, I mean, I don't know. It's a, you know, it's a...
Well, I'm 39 now, so yeah.
Well, gosh, I am
very young.
I am too, and I agree. And it feels like my salad days are behind me. I'm curious about... Because I think this industry is very chaotic and confusing. There's no blueprint for how to succeed. There's no blueprint for even how to execute. It's a little bit like the Wild West sometimes, or what I assume the Wild West was like. And I'm just curious, you coming in, it sounds like you did some research. You have that business acumen. But how do you even know that you need to go to a film financier? How do you find that person? How do you even know that you need to go to a sales agent? Like, what resources gave you the foundation to put this film together in a way that, at least from the outside, the optics are that it's very successful?
First resource I'll state is Making Movies is Hard podcast. That's
well, this was a planned hard question, and thank you very much.
No, but seriously, like I alluded to, you know, those 6 years, part of the reason it took so long was not just because it's a documentary where the story's unfolding in front of us and we want to capture it. That's part of it, but that's not the big part. I think part of the big part was that I was going through my film school process during the making of this film. So I think there's a few things. I think one thing is that we brought on like really amazing filmmakers who have been in the industry for a long time, maybe not making feature docs, but like I said, from, you know, maybe the motion picture, bigger budget studio world to the commercial world, those producers, like I said, Esteban Padilla, Audrey Glockner, like we brought these people on to really help like light the path a little bit. So there's that. And then also I think, yeah, just a tremendous amount of just like head down learning and talking to people and curiosity, you know, like honestly, listening to podcasts, listening to this podcast, listening to podcasts like Just Shoot It, these other, you know, these were incredible resources for me throughout the process. And I also do think that because I do have this commercial directing career that I carved out, that also afforded me opportunities to connect with other folks that were doing documentaries while they were doing commercial producing or whatever, or was in the narrative space. So that I think the commercial world really opened up my network to different filmmakers who kind of showed me, you know, what the steps look like. But honestly, mostly it was trial and error, you know, through my executive producer, Jeff Sobrato, who he came off, it was off the tails of doing a Matt Heineman narrative film, A Private War. And, you know, I think he kind of steered some of the bigger milestones. He showed us which ones we need to really go after. And then as we hit some of those milestones, you know, we got a really fancy sales agent really quick, and that didn't work out. But during the time we had them, you know, they told us what the steps were, you know, mm-hmm. So it was just a process of getting some people who believed at least in the story, however, in whatever way it connected to them, and then them just helping us kind of map things out a little bit.
All right. Now I want to cut to the end a little bit and we'll go back to the middle, but I want to know like how did the sales process work out? Like, where did you end up landing? And like, you know, this is a really hard question to answer, but like, do you expect that you'll get a return on the investment of the movie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I love about your guys' podcast. You guys ask all the questions that, you know, it's just like directors talking. These are the questions we ask ourselves in coffee shops, right? When we meet and we're doing it on air. So the sales process was tough, you know, like I said before, we had really some of the biggest documentary sales agents jump on board to rep us very early before we even had a full cut of the film. They saw like a little sizzle that we put together and some of the reenactment work that we did, and they loved it so much that they wanted to help out. And when that company was bought, you know, we were released, and it was just during a time too where I think, Liz, as you know, right, the documentary market shifted so radically, especially starting in, I guess, late 2022, right? Or
yeah, where, in the past couple of years.
Yeah. You know, and then we start hearing like, oh, nothing sold out of Sundance and this and that, you know? So I think we went really quickly from having these sales or these reps that we thought could sell the film to a streamer. We were lucky enough to land our premiere at Doc NYC, which is a festival that I was always very excited, like crossing my fingers that we get into. And we got into there. And then at that point, we kind of had to figure out, okay, we need a sales agent. So lucky enough, we were working with Jeff Sobrato's, our EP's production company, Safe Space. And under Safe Space, the person who was leading documentaries there during the time was Ryan Harrington, who is like a doc legend. And Liz, you know him, right?
Yeah.
Brian's the best. He's just the best. He really showed me kind of the steps we needed to take in order to figure this thing out. But Ryan also threw his hands up in the air and told me that like things are changing so rapidly. Like we're going to figure it out on the fly as well. So, but it felt really good to have his help to figure out the steps I needed to take. But we reached out to a lot of sales reps during that time. And because streamers were really looking for international content and we were being pegged as a California-based prison system documentary, you know, not even, you know, with broad domestic appeal, but a California story, which I don't think it is. We, you know, reps were like, oh, sorry, we're going to have to pass on this. We really, you know, didn't get much help there. So I went around, and actually this comes back to Liz, and I don't know if Liz, if you remember, but you know, I reached out a little bit. Okay. I'll fill you back in. But you know, during that time where we were looking for reps, I reached out to a few different distribution consultants, and Liz Manischel was one of them. And Liz, you seems like you forget this call. You're probably sleep deprived and stuff, but like you injected a lot of belief back in the project, honestly. You know, I think the ebbs and flows when you're going through 6 years, there's times where you are so utterly connected and you believe in what you're doing. And there's other times where you are rock bottom and you're like, wow, maybe I made a shit film, or maybe this doesn't mean the things I think it should mean to others, you know? But I remember Liz, based on you watching the trailer and me explaining the film to you, you were like, that you have something here and, you know, go out and get it, you know? So we almost worked together. But what happened during that time was that we did find reps with Obscured Pictures, and we had basically three offers from different distributors. And we ultimately went with Grasshopper Film, mm-hmm. which is a distributor out of Brooklyn, independent distributor that does a lot of like really, really great films from like Berlin and Cannes and stuff like that. Lesser known stuff, but like incredible, incredible slate of films. And so we aligned ourselves with them, and that's where we are today.
Thank you for saying that. That was very nice of you, Brenton.
Well, you didn't answer part of the
second
question,
part,
which is like, do you expect to get a return on your investment? Because I know it's not a question that anybody really wants to answer, but it's like the thing that I know about my movie, and I've talked about openly on the podcast, that like we're likely not going to ever, you know, and not even scratch the surface. So I just would, if you're willing to answer that part of the question, I'd love to hear it.
Honestly, I don't know if I should answer this question or not, but I'm gonna. I believe in transparency and helping our fellow filmmakers out. I don't think so. I don't think we will. You know, I think me and our investor, you know, Jeff, like we talked about, we knew this was a mission-based film for us. I know we always wanted to get our money back. And I think there was a possibility, especially back when we had our original sales reps, where they were projecting something. It was when Netflix was, you know, still making social impact. They were buying social impact films for seven figures sometimes, you know? It was rare, but they were doing it. And then that dwindled radically and quickly. So I think now that we're streaming right now, we're TVOD on Apple TV and Amazon Prime, and that's going really well. You know, we hit number, I think, 5 or 6 on the charts of Apple TV this week, which I'm really stoked about. But I don't know what that means from a money standpoint. You know, I think distribution is kind of like its own black hole, and you give up a lot to distributors. And I love the people at Grasshopper, but that's just the rules of the game. And I knew the rules when I was getting into it. And so you give up that, and then you have, of course, your investor waterfall and all that. So if the question is like, are me and my producers going to get money back? I think unless something happens, whereas like a hypothetical, like somebody like a Kim Kardashian, who's one of the biggest celebrities in the world and who has connections to criminal justice reform and really cares about it.
She's a big fan of our podcast, by the way. So I think Perfect. We can get her. So, yeah.
All right, good. All right. So Kim, yeah, making this financially viable is dependent on you. So you're listening. But yeah, I don't think that's going to be the case. I don't think we're going to make our money back on this. But I also do think, once again, it's one of those like social impact films that with the right level of support, and we've been engaging with different celebrities and all that who really like the film, and they were trying to find ways to figure out how to support. But with the right level of support, maybe we strike dynamite, but you know, that's not a good business model to just like kind of hope and pray on that.
I have so many filmmakers that we start working together, or even if we just have an initial call, and the number one thing they say is, I'm exhausted. That's like the majority of the call is how tired they are. And you said in the beginning of the chat, and I've always said, and Ulrich has always said, you know, it's a marathon, and people always think the finish line is like sound lock, but the finish line is much farther than that. If you were able just to give people a sense of your timeline after sound lock until when you anticipate your efforts in distribution will be over, do you have a sense of that right now?
I do. Yeah. And man, these are just the best questions.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/westwoodone.
When I grow up, I'm going to be a veterinarian.
It's awesome.
And I'm going to be what you said we need more of.
So you want to be a plumbernarian?
Do you think I can?
I think that if you work really hard, you can be anything.
Promise?
You bet I do.
When you promise your kids the world, we're here to help you keep it. Ohio's 529 plan is the best tax-free savings plan for future college or career training nationwide. Start now at collegeadvantage.com.
Treat dad to the good stuff at Nordstrom Rack and save big. Father's Day is Sunday, June 16th, and Nordstrom Rack's got gifts dad will love, up to 60% off. Shirts, activewear, watches, cologne, denim, and more. Find amazing deals on Tommy Bahama, Cole Haan, Original Penguin, and Vince. Great brands, great prices. So get to your Nordstrom Rack store now and make dad's day with gifts up to 60% off.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to appreciate all the ways Black music brings everyone together. From the Saturday morning soundtrack that gets the whole family cleaning the house, to the beats at the block parties that bring the whole community together, celebrate the impact of Black music this month and beyond with State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
This is what we all want to know. So we locked sound, color was finished, all that. February, I think, of 2022. We're in 2024 right now. So once we got to that point, Ulrich, you know this theater. We did a team screening at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland. Kind of celebrated that everything was locked. This is the film. We're going to go out into the world and share this. And by that time, we knew, you know, we didn't get into Sundance or South By or whatever. And we were waiting for our premiere festival at that point. And we had a couple really amazing doc festivals that offered premiere status, or offered to screen if we give them premiere status. But I was kind of just waiting on Doc NYC for what, well, I don't know why I was. But somehow we did get into that, to Doc NYC, and we were under US competition there, which was a great experience. But from there to Doc NYC was another 10 months of waiting, right? So we waited for 10 months to do our first premiere. And then, you know, we have a 2022 premiere, even though it's really kind of 2023 because it's late November of 2022. And then we go on our full festival run in 2023. And so I'm traveling to any festivals I could afford to travel to. We have a little bit of an impact budget that we can like give to myself a little bit for travel, and then some of the participants in the film. And we're going around trying to spread the good word of what we've created and the word of these men in the program. And so we're on the road all of 2023 going to festivals and also doing impact screenings as well. So we've been invited to different groups in different states across the US. They could be treatment organizations, they could be corrections organizations, they could be in any of these different institutions that align with the themes and subject matter of the film. And so we've been doing screenings like that as well. And so that takes up 2023. And now we're in 2024, and we've been waiting for this month right now, which is deemed Second Chances Month, which nobody really knows about, but it's an awesome concept. President Biden signed it into existence a few years back. And it's about celebrating and uplifting the idea of second chances, specifically around justice impacted individuals. And so Grasshopper and myself decided that we're gonna release for this month. And so once again, then you're waiting 4 extra months to April. You're getting everything aligned and putting together a small marketing team with a little budget that we have. And now we're in release mode and we're doing screenings around California. We'll be doing a screening in DC. So now we're getting it out there. And I think really for the next month and a half to 2 months, a lot of my efforts is really focusing on marketing, on press, as much press as we could drum up, and as many screenings as we could do. And that's my life right now. And there's going to be also a long tail up continue. We'll continue to get inquiries from different state governments and such to do screenings and all that. So I will continue to manage this in the background, who knows, for the rest of my life, while now moving into the next projects I'm jumping on as well.
So you talk about this as a second career. So is this now like everything that you do, like you do corporate video to pay the bills and then you make movies on the side? That's like the thing? Or are you still doing some of your other work at the same time?
No, I only do film related work now. The glamour stuff that you and I know, Ulrich, of like corporate video. I do that stuff. That's what pays the bills in the Bay. And I always take it as an opportunity to not only feed my family, but also like learn the technical aspect of filmmaking. So I really, really enjoy that. I'm also a commercial director as well. I do commercials. I'm repped by an awesome production company called Invisible Collective out of LA. And so that's a sliver of my work as well. So I would say corporate, some more like branded content / commercial content is a sliver of my work as well. And then, yeah, right now I'm currently developing a few other docs, really early stages, working on a narrative short, all these other things that there's no immediacy to the financial return for myself, you know, but that's like another sandbox that I continue to maintain while there's other more kind of revenue generating ventures, but it's all in the realm of directing, producing, and all that.
So part two of the question, I know we're running out of time here, but like, so it's kind of amazing. It's a comment than a question. So it's amazing that at 32, you jumped into this industry. Now you're basically doing corporate video, you're directing commercials, you've made your first feature, you got all these other projects. Like, what was the whole goal of moving into this industry? And like, where are you headed? Like, is it doc filmmaking forever? Or is it like you're saying, you're doing a narrative short? Are you trying to get into the narrative space? Do you want to do both? Like, where do you see all these efforts of the last 7 years leading to, you know, in your eventual like next 5, 10 years of your career?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think I'm coming to a point where I'm trying... And this is so not me. I'm a control freak, as so many of us are. I'm always trying to figure out, you know, the trajectory of my life. But I'm also, like I alluded to before, I feel like the harder I grip, the harder I lose sight of what the core of it all is, you know? So I do have a vision, but I keep the vision kind of malleable. My ultimate vision, you know, would be to continue down the path of feature / episodic doc making along with narrative work in the feature world as well. You know, I mean, the Vim Vendors type of model that I feel really funny even saying his name next to mine, but that's like, you know, that like what he's done with his career to be able to like to create the work that he wants and go between fiction and nonfiction so seamlessly. I love those two worlds. And I oftentimes with my doc work, and this was never the intention, but with my doc work, I oftentimes see glimmers or just little things in those stories that activate something in me in order to write a short script or maybe a feature script, you know? So there is this like kind of cross-pollination that happens sometimes with stories, but not only that, but in terms of it informs even from a technical and craft standpoint, both of those worlds inform the other for me. So that is the dream would be to live between those two worlds.
Amazing.
So it's time for our final 6 questions, but we'll try to do these a little bit more short answers so that we could fit them all in, because I think we want to hear everything we can from you. What's the first film you ever made? I think we kind of heard about it the past hour, but what's the first film you ever made? Maybe one of the shorts that you've done before. How do you feel about it now?
So the first film I ever made was a short documentary called Tender Souls. And it was about three different people in different stages of either their addiction or recovery in the Tenderloin in San Francisco. And I still love it. I see a lot of myself and my development in it. And then I love the people in it. I still am friends with them. I still cheer them on, and we still have relationships. So yeah, I love it for that reason as well.
What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Oh, I know. I was trying to prep for this one before, and I don't know if I got it. You know what? I think it's from my wife, who's not a filmmaker. She told me to make stuff for me, stuff that I love, stuff that I care about, stuff that's personal. Make for me, don't make for anybody else. She kind of, I think, channeled her inner Rick Rubin and saw me get distracted by too many things. And she kind of snapped me back. She's like, you know, make for you. Don't make for this imaginary buyer that you're projecting out towards, you know, make for yourself.
What's the worst advice you've ever received, filmmaking or otherwise?
The worst advice I ever received, I would say be practical, honestly. Like this is hard for me to say as a 39-year-old filmmaker with two kids, because I am ultra practical.
You just described all three of us.
I know, right?
We're all 39-year-old filmmakers with two kids.
Oh, that's amazing.
That is something. We're a very, very narrow niche.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, on the filmmaking side, once again, I'll get, you know, back to the themes of what we talked about. But I think if you go through with this too long, or if you're in this world, there'll be times where you are forced to be practical. You're forced to submit or succumb to the pressures of something that's external. I think you always just have to figure out ways. I mean, Ulrich, I'm inspired by you because you've always figured out ways to do the stories you've meant to make, you know? So pragmatism has its place, but when it comes to being an artist, you need to be able to bifurcate between the need for pragmatism and the need to just to be and to create.
Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
I think my goal has always been, I think it's two part. My goal is to be the best filmmaker I can be, the best craftsperson I could be, to understand and give respect to like the amazing craft and complex and layered craft that is filmmaking, and be the best version of myself within that as a storyteller, as a director, as a person that gets, you know, my hands dirty with footage and cuts and does all that. Like, I want to be the best craftsperson I could be. And then I want to tell stories that move people internally while also having the possibility and potency of creating some type of ripple effects on the outside that has some type of like social meaning and impact. You know, in the 50 is a very good example of that, of me kind of hitting that particular goal. I want to continue to make those films.
If you could go back in time, what's the one piece of advice you would give yourself?
I would say to be kind to yourself, to confront yourself, and to shine the light towards your own darkness. And it's never as dark and scary as you project it to be. In that darkness, and I say this for all people, and I say this for us as artists, right? That's where the possibilities of healing lives. That's where the possibilities of us as artists, like of true storytelling and artistry lives. And so I think my younger self was petrified to really understand myself. And I still, 39-year-old Brenton still fears that quite a bit, but I've gotten better and I've gotten more courageous. And my hope in the 50, you know, not to plug the film again, but the 50 speaks to that. It speaks to that courage of truly investigating and looking at oneself, the dark corners, the beauty, the light. So I would say to be courageous and to do that work.
Last question, is making movies hard?
Can I swear on this? I already swore before.
Yes.
Yeah. Fuck yeah. It's hard. It's hard, but it's the most fun you could have, right? Like, to be able to transmute parts of yourself onto, you know, a screen through visual, through audio, through something that could reach out and touch other people. Like, man, like what a privilege, what an amazing thing to like kind of witness and be the catalyst in that transmutation process. It's incredible, but man, yeah, I mean, you're going to be confronted by every single obstacle imaginable pushing back on you. And I guess when you overcome some of those obstacles, that's what also makes it sweet.
Thanks for being on the show. This was really lovely.
You guys are lovely.
Okay, so shout out things to support you. Do the shouting?
Okay. I'll raise my volume a little bit. So yeah, I mean, I hope that people go and check out the 50. Like I said, we released on April 9th of 2024. So we just came out. We're on Apple TV, we're on Prime Video, and it's floating up the charts of Apple TV, which I'm super proud of. I was just sandwiched between Wim Wenders' latest documentary and Stop Making Sense, Talking Heads thing. And I wanted to, as a kid, I wanted to be David Byrne. And to be sandwiched between my two heroes was like the coolest thing ever. So please go out and watch that and support. You could find me. I'm on Instagram at Brenton Gieser, G-I-E-S-E-R. And then my website and everything else on social is just Brenton Gieser. Keep it simple like that.
Liz, what do you remember about our talk with Brenton?
That I didn't really want to have it in the first place. You and I talked beforehand and we were like, Brenton like did the Just Shoot It podcast. We're like coming on the heels of that. We need to make sure we talk about something different. Ulrich's way more flexible, but I'm like the one who's like, I don't want someone who's doing the like podcast circuit to be on our show. But what I remember is almost immediately, Brenton has this authenticity to him, this vulnerability, this honest, like he was very candid with us. And it just took me, it like made me very grateful that we decided to do the interview because I thought it was a wonderful conversation. But I just remember like my mind being changed. That's the takeaway for me. What do you remember?
Wow. That's awesome. Well, Brenton's a Bay Area filmmaking homie, first off. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to have him on the show for that reason. And because I know him personally and I've worked with him before on some projects back in my freelancing days, you know, so I just thought Brenton's cool. We have a couple of mutual friends, you know, in common. So it's just like, yeah, dude, like I was like, yeah. And I've been seeing about his movie for a while. I'd seen the trailer. I've been hearing a little bit about him, you know, personally from the story of making the movie. So I was like, yeah, he's coming on the show for sure. And then Liz was like, oh, he was on Just Shoot It. I don't want that. I was like, it'll be fine. It's going to be good.
Well,
like,
you were right.
You know, and I mean, my basic thought is like, if someone's on another show, you know, and I wouldn't say especially Just Shoot It, but Just Shoot It is a good example because I feel like Matt and Oren ask very different types of questions than you and I ask, and they go in different directions than we go. And I just feel like it's going to be a different, even if we like had the same list of bullet points of questions, like the conversation is going to be different between us.
Well, but so, if I'm just looking through Indie Film Podcast and I had just listened to the Just Shoot at Brenton Gieser episode, I'm not going to listen to ours. You know what I mean? Like, so I think that's the risk that we take. But the hope is that someone doesn't listen to theirs and listens to ours. That's what the hope. Sorry, Matt and Oren. No, the hope is they listen to both of us, but I wouldn't be double dipping on someone.
I have double dipped sometimes. And I think I do it when it's someone that I'm really interested in and I really enjoy the conversation. And I just couldn't get enough of it.
Yeah.
Then I want to do it some more.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where that comes from. Let's see. Will you like Batman? Is that going to make you happy? Or would you hold Batman?
I'm going to take this time to segue to our next segment, though. It's not Batman, but it is the game. Okay, what's the game? The game is a segment handmade from our producer, Eric Toms. He puts together a hypothetical problem that could happen on an indie film set or indie film pre-production or development. And Ulrich and I hear the question blindly, and we answer blindly immediately upon hearing the question. I hope that I'm using that phrase properly. So here is Ulrich's response to this week's game question. So Ulrich, you're gearing up for a low budget bio feature, a biopic about one of your favorite musicians' lives. This musician had a tumultuous childhood that really shaped their art and music, and you're striving to capture the realism of their situation. This musician gained fame here in the United States, but was born abroad. So when it comes to filming locations, traveling to their home country would be very expensive. You want to tell their story, but you'd be able to add so many more details and various scenes if you shot the U.S. for their country. Do you, A, travel to the musician's country to show a more authentic background? B, shoot here in the U.S. but give the audience a more robust story? C, tell the story of the musician's childhood through pictures or dialogue and bypass it altogether? Or D, other? What do you do, director? What do you do?
I'm sorry, I have to ask some more clarifying questions about this question. So
yeah,
they're saying that like it's going to be a more robust story if we shoot it in America because that's where a lot of his music past took place.
No, I think he's saying, what I got from that is like the cost of traveling the film would be meaningful. But if you didn't spend to travel the film to that birth country, you could put more money on the screen in other ways.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. It's a tough question. I guess, does it say what? It's just a biopic about, it's just a documentary about the artist. Are they dead or are they alive?
It's a biopic, so not a documentary. And it doesn't say.
It's a biopic. It's okay.
It doesn't say whether they're dead or they're alive. So I can't speak to that.
Huh. So, but clearly part of the story would take place in the other country. It doesn't say which country it is.
Yeah, it's just not the US. And it just says, yeah, it doesn't say, it's funny. Yeah, it doesn't say like the script features scenes in this birth country, right? But it does say that the musician had a tumultuous child that really shaped their art and music. So I think Eric is implying that, you know, that period of their life would be meaningful to depict.
Okay. So my answer, it depends like greatly on the country that they came from. Because if it's a country that like is easily faked in America, then let's just fake it. Let's get some stock footage. Let's, you know, not stock necessarily. Or like we could send like, we could hire a crew like in that country and like shoot B-roll plates and stuff. And like, I don't necessarily have to move the whole production there. Like we could just get pieces. Or we could shoot like, you know, on a volume maybe and like, you know, have like locations. I don't know. Like there's just a lots of things. Or we could build sets, you know, here. Like there's just a lot of other options. It just kind of depends on like what, like it really depends on the story and the script, you know, because there's a lot of biopics where you don't necessarily have to like go show the childhood. And I actually kind of hate it when they spend a lot of time on the childhood because it's like, who fucking cares about the childhood? Like I care about when this person started playing music, you know, like I don't need to see them getting beaten by their mom, you know, or whatever. Like that's not as important to me. Like I'd rather, like I thought a really good one. Have you seen Billie Holiday one, like Billie Holiday versus United States or whatever?
No, not yet.
Oh man, that was like a really, really good biopic. And they basically focused on one moment in time for her, like near the end of her career. And they didn't like go a lot of flashbacks. They didn't show her like rising the ranks as a singer and all that stuff. It was like really just about this time in her life at the end of her career. And it was amazing, you know? So I feel like, yeah, I don't necessarily know, like just based off of a biopic about a musician you liked who had a tumultuous childhood that was in another country. Like that doesn't necessarily mean to me that I have to be in the other country. So I think what I would do is that it would all be script dependent and story dependent. And like, what story do I want to tell about this artist? So I'd have to like really take a good look at what that is and then decide like how important shooting on location is. And for a documentary, I kind of feel like it's probably even more important, but for like a biopic, you know, narrative, a fiction film, I think it's less important. I think it's more about like just this, the characters and the story and the performances, and that like the locations. Yeah, okay. You can find really beautiful locations here in America that would work potentially for certain countries, you know, and you don't necessarily have to go to like the fields of Ireland to like, you know, have a beautiful field. Although I know that's very specific also looking. So I don't know. I think it just really depends on the story, but I would, yeah, I'd rather shoot a robust movie in America because like having more budget to like, you know, make the production value better and have a better team, not necessarily a better team, but like a more fulfilled out team. I think that is probably more important than Benny, what exactly do you want? What can I give you to stop?
He thinks you should go to the home country. He's upset with you.
He doesn't like my answer.
He doesn't like your answer.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think I would probably do a combination of the answers, like probably like mm-hmm. D, where it'd be like, use the money to put it into the production to make it more robust and better cast and, you know, all those things. And then if I did need to get any international stuff, then I would send have a crew there that would shoot it.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't necessarily be anything with the main star. It would be like pickup scenes or little pieces. But yeah, I would rather focus on the artists in their prime or in a moment of their life that is big and important that wouldn't necessarily be in that other country, but it would be like where they, you know, had their fame, their music fame, which I would imagine would be most likely in the United States. But I guess it depends on who it is. So I don't know. Is that a bullshit answer?
No, I'm with you on the second unit. Like, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think the only thing we differ is that I'm obsessed with the why. You know, why is that person driven to succeed? What happened to them? I do believe in critical periods. I do believe in like trauma that leads to like an overachiever. Like, all that stuff is really interesting to me. So I do want to show the childhood, but I think that filmmaking is manipulation and you don't need to be in Ireland to reflect an Irish location. So just like you said, set building, kind of faking it is fine with me, especially if you don't have the money to make it exactly how you want it to be. So I would do something very similar, except for I would focus on their childhood. That's the only difference.
Yeah, I kind of like, I love stories where it doesn't, like the, you know, Ray, right? Like, we've all seen Ray, I'm assuming.
I don't think I've seen Ray, actually.
What? Oh my God. Okay. Well, damn it, Liz. It's a really good movie and it's a really good biopic, but it's like basically like this biopic that I feel like to me is like what all biopics do now. It's like they follow that same structure of mm-hmm. Ray, and they've made fun of it a thousand times in like so many sketches. And, you know, there's a whole movie, the one of John C. Reilly where
Walk Hard: The Dewey Cox Story.
Yeah, it's like it's making fun of Ray. It's making fun of the Johnny Cash. Walk the Line is basically like a copy of Ray, but just with Johnny Cash, you know, essentially.
Yeah.
So it's just like, I don't know, man. Like, I'm just so tired of those types of biopics. So I want to make one that would be more like this Billie Holiday one, where it's like a moment in time. But it tells you all you need to know about the character, you know, within that period or whatever.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like how I loved Rocket Man, but I couldn't stand Bohemian Rhapsody, because Rocket Man was a lot more of a manipulation of the truth in order to get at something deeper, whereas Bohemian Rhapsody just had no flavor to it, right? No perspective or point of view. So I totally understand
both
what you're saying.
Movies, and I totally agree with what you're saying. Yeah, although I didn't mind Bohemian Rhapsody, it's like it was lifeless and soulless, and I mean, it had no anything. And then Rocket Man felt like a really good movie and really good characters, and just like
more interesting.
Had a lot more to say, you know.
I feel like you got to know Elton John better, even if it was kind of this magical realism thing, you know.
Right.
But do you out there in TV land, do you disagree with us? Do you agree with us? Send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Thanks to Brenton Geezer for coming on the show. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Most importantly, thank you, all of you, for listening, and talk to you all next week.
We gotta cut that part off.
Oh, no, I think we just have to announce it. Ulrich picked up his son and smelled his butt. That's what Ulrich just did.
I was like, what is that smell? What's going on? Like, did they make a mistake with the sewer? Is there something going on with my piping? And then I was like, oh, it's just my son did a big poop. Okay.
Oh, that was a very relatable moment. Yeah.
This Black Music Month, State Farm wants to take a moment to recognize the undeniable cultural influence of Black musicians, composers, singers, and songwriters. From folk music to rock and roll, jazz, and more, Black culture has shaped almost every genre of music that exists today. Join State Farm in celebrating this month and beyond. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
When I grow up, I'm going to be a veterinarian?
It's awesome.
And I'm going to be what you said we need more of.
So you want to be a plumber-narian?
Do you think I can?
I think that if you work really hard, you can be anything.
Promise?
You bet I do.
When you promise your kids the world, we're here to help you keep it. Ohio's 529 plan is the best tax-free savings plan for future college or career training nationwide. Start now at collegeadvantage.com.
Treat dad to the good stuff at Nordstrom Rack and save big. Father's Day is Sunday, June 16th, and Nordstrom Rack's got gifts dad will love, up to 60% off. Shirts, activewear, watches, cologne, denim, and more. Find amazing deals on Tommy Bahama, Cole Haan, Original Penguin, and Vince. Great brands, great prices. So get to your Nordstrom Rack store now and make dad's day with gifts up to 60% off.
Imagine bold, naturally aged Tillamook cheddar slices melting over a burger. Eating thick-cut cheddar shreds straight from the bag. It's nice to dream about cheese for a bit. Tillamook cheddar. Extraordinary dairy.
Cheers to a great day and this ice-cold Corona.
You know what would make this day even better? My grandma's carne asada.
Or your grandma here with us, making carne asada.
She does love a cold Corona.
Throw in some dancing.
Oh, we can watch the game.
I'll drink to that.
So a backyard concert with football, food, dancing, and Corona?
And your grandma.
Or we could keep it simple.
Simple is good. Want a Corona?
Thanks. Salud to the perfect day.
Corona, la vida más fina. Get your Corona at ordercorona.com. Relax responsibly. Corona Extra Beer, imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.